Book of Ruth, chapter 4 this morning, and we're looking at a topic of love and commitment, love and commitment. Now, before we get into the portion of Scripture that we're going to look at, I wanted to just briefly highlight a couple things, little background issues. And the first one would be, as we look at the story, much of it takes place around the city gate. Now, I think we have a illustration of the city gate. It's on the back here. As you look, you come through the gate and you see these rooms on either side. That would be the place where a lot of business would take place and a lot of city matters would be taking place. So contracts, business agreements, city decisions, etc., will all be done in the city gate. So if you remember in the Old Testament, when David was king, his son Absalom would preempt people before they got into the city gate when they had complaints or issues to be dealt with and they wanted to see the king. Well, he would go before the city gate and around there and interrupt them and them going to the city gate and try to win their favor and say he was on their side. And he won the people's hearts because of that. So in the city gate was a very important part of Jewish life. And here, the city of Bethlehem, they have a city gate, and this is where much of this incident takes place. Another thing that was important here for us to understand, it's kind of an odd custom in our thinking, but this is the way they did it in those days. In verse 7, it talks about something that has to do with someone's sandal and how that played an important part in transfer of property or the recognition of a legal signature on a document, so to speak, as we do it. But in verse 7, it says, now in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So, if you can imagine, they have been negotiating and talking about how to transfer this property, and all of a sudden the guy says, okay, I agree, and then he takes off his shoe and hands it to the guy. And you go, what in the world does that mean? What do I need with a dirty shoe? You know, guy who owns a lot of property has a closet full of one shoes. You know, what is that all about? Well, you remember in the book of Deuteronomy, and God had promised the land to Israel, and he makes this statement. He says, wherever you set your foot, that land will be yours. Your frontiers will stretch from the wilderness in the south to Lebanon in the north, and from the Euphrates River in the east to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. What God is saying here is that wherever you set your foot, that will be your land. In other words, you'll have the right to that land. You can walk wherever you want to in that area. Wherever you set your foot, it'll be yours. So taking from that, the idea was that where you put your foot, where you were allowed to go, was yours. And so to symbolize that land was now belonging to somebody else, they would take their shoe and say, now, I no longer have the right to walk on that land. It's not mine anymore. It's yours. And here's my shoe. Does that make any sense? So when we talk about that, that's what he's talking about in this portion of Scripture. Now, let's go to verse 1. It says, meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the family guardian had mentioned, came along. And Boaz said, come over here, my friend, and sit down. So he went over and sat down. And Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here. And they did so. Then he said to the family guardian, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line. I will redeem it, he said. Then Boaz said, on the day that you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. At this, the family guardian said, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. So here's the situation we find Boaz in. Remember, Ruth went and went to where Boaz was harvesting. Remember, he was taking and winnowing the grain, and he slept there by the grain piles that night. And in the middle of the night, Ruth came by and slept at his feet and took the cover off his bottom half, uncovered his feet, and he woke up in the middle of the night, and he says, who are you? What are you doing here? And then they had an exchange, and she basically told him that, put your shawl over me, meaning I want you to marry me, and take on the responsibility of the family guardian, and which would be to produce an offspring so that the family name will continue, and this whole thing. So when Boaz heard this, he went and went into a statement where he said, you know, he was just excited. I guess we want to put this that way. He was like, this is the best thing that you've done since you helped Naomi. I mean, you're amazing. And he was, you could tell he was just excited about this. And he says, you know, I'm going to take care of this, but I want you to know there's another person who has more right to you than me, but I'm going to take care of this. And then when Naomi went back to Naomi, Naomi said, don't worry, he won't let it rest until he has this thing resolved. So we have this situation where now Boaz has got to enter into a negotiation, so to speak, in the behalf of Naomi and on behalf of Ruth. And so he finds that as he gets into the city gate, he's already been thinking about this. He's already been deliberating of how he's going to handle this and how he's going to approach this. And as he gets there into the city gate, lo and behold, this guy comes along by coincidence. Have you noticed that there really aren't any coincidences as far as God's concerned? So what we see here is that this was something that God was involved in. As he brings this man to the city gate just at the time that Boaz is there. And we find that Boaz addresses him as friend in the New International Version. What does yours say? Is it the same thing, friend? Okay. The words there in the Hebrew are a little different. The words are Poloni Almoni. Poloni Almoni. Remember that? Very significant. But what that really meant was, it was a kind of a vague term. It meant a certain someone, or you so-and-so. So the narrator gives this person that name in the situation. Doesn't give his real name. It's so-and-so. Now, why does it put it that way? I believe that it was to show that this person wasn't respectable. There was something wrong here in this situation that has to do with this man. And so we're not going to mention names. We're just going to call him so-and-so. And we'll see, of course, as the story goes along, he backs out of the whole deal. So Boaz, as he's entering into these negotiations, he's not just interested in land. In fact, I don't think that's what he was really interested in. From the story, we find that he's really interested in Ruth. And so in order to have her as his wife is what he really wants. To do that, he's got to approach this with a little bit of forethought, because these kind of situations can get away from you, and things can go a certain way that you'd never intended. So he wants to think this through of how he's going to handle this situation. And so as we look at this, instead of just saying what he wants, I really want to marry Ruth, so could I have this property? Now, if you're doing that, you're already letting people know what you want. Guess what happens to the price? And they may just say, no, you know what? I think I'm going to go for this myself. So the way he handles this is very very strategic, and how he sets forth his plan of how he's going to wrap this up. So in order for him to navigate this situation, he has to be very prudent. Now, prudence is something that you all want to have. To be a prudent person is something the Bible said is very good. Now, we don't usually use that word, but it is something that's very important. So, in the Bible, being prudent was an important thing because we live in a world that's fallen. So, to be prudent, you need to be prudent because we live in a fallen world. Prudence, as far as a Jew was concerned, meant, how do I avoid danger in a world of evil as I move out to love and obey God? See, you had to recognize that there was danger in the world. There are things could go wrong. Not necessarily they will go wrong. So it was in between a person who is naive and think that everything is going to go as they think, where everything goes as people say they will, and a cynic who says nothing goes as it's said. You can't believe anything. So in between these two, you have a person who's prudent, who recognizes that things aren't always as they seem. Things aren't always good. People aren't always right. They don't always do the good thing. But neither do I want to say that it all is evil and wrong. God can still work in this situation, and I want to do the prudent thing. I want to do the wise thing in the situation. So, if you want to be prudent, you need to watch what you say. Think before you speak. A couple of scriptures there in the Bible talk about prudence, especially in Proverbs. Proverbs 10:19, Proverbs 12:16, they deal with a couple things dealing with prudence. And it says here in Proverbs 10:19, sin is not ended by multiplying words, but the prudent hold their tongues. Proverbs 12:16, fools show their annoyance at once, but the prudent overlook an insult. See, Boaz had been thinking about this whole thing. When Ruth came to him in the middle of the night and woke him up, and he asked her what she wanted, what was she there for, and she spoke about it, he already knew that there was somebody else who was first in line. Now, how did that come to his mind right away like that? I believe it's because he's already been thinking about this. He just hasn't done anything about it. And when she came to him, he already had thought about this, and he's already starting to form an idea of what he's going to do in the situation. And so he had a response for her right then, and he knew that this was going to be something that he had to take care of. Now, how many of you would agree that what we say can get us into trouble? Oh, a bunch of prudent people out there. It can make things better, or it can make things worse. So it is the prudent thing to measure your words, think about what you say, think about how it's going to be received, what it is that you really want to say, rather than just speaking extemporaneously of whatever pops in your head, because a lot of times when you do that, you spend a lot of time trying to clean up the mess that you make. And so we find that He was going to make sure that he said the right thing in the negotiations, that he measured his words and how he said them and what he said. In fact, you notice that when he comes and he talks to the individuals in this group, he's very flat. Look at the statements he makes. It's very businesslike. It's very unemotional. Just strictly, you know, here's what we need to do, and if you want to do it, fine. If you don't, he doesn't just throw everything out and say how I feel and what I want to do. He holds back and just tries to present this thing because he's in a negotiation. See, here's the issues. He had to present all the issues in this situation in a way that would make it more favorable to him. Let me look at a couple more scriptures first. In Proverbs chapter 14, another thing about prudence is that you think before you act. Proverbs 14:8 says this: the wisdom of the prudent is to give thought to their ways, but the folly of the fool is deception. Proverbs 14:15 says this: the simple believe anything, but the prudent give thought to their steps. So he thought about what he was going to say and how he was going to say it, and he thought about what he was going to do when he was in the negotiations. Now, the fact is that whoever got property in this way would have to take care of Naomi. So if he decided he's going to buy this piece of property, he realized that when you buy this piece of property, you're going to have to take care of Naomi, and she was older, which is, you know, okay. And she would last a few years, and you have to provide for her, make sure she's not going to be homeless. And then after she dies, then the property is free and clear, it's yours. So he starts off with telling this Mr. So-and-so that the property was going to be put up for sale. Naomi needed that kind of support. And if you wanted to do it, you're first in line. And what did he do? He says, I'm in. Okay, now what does that do? It locks you into a price. He's now said that's in front of the 10 elders and some of the people that are hanging around, some of the witnesses. He's already said, this is what I'll pay for this property. Now, to just leave it out and not say anything about Ruth would be very dishonest. So Boaz then mentions this, that Ruth is also tied up in this. Ruth, being the wife of one of Naomi's sons, has the right to have his name, Mahlon, his name continued in the family of Elimelech. And so if you buy this property, you're also obligated to marry the daughter-in-law of Naomi. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that you now will marry her. That costs money. And if you know anything about weddings, I'm sure you know it costs a lot. I hope it didn't cost that much then. But anyhow, you find that he has to get married. He also has to raise children, and one of them has to be a son so he can pass on the name. He has to support this family. And then when the son gets to be a certain age, say 15, then the property goes over to him. And there you are. What do you have? Money going out of the pocket the whole time. Now, you might get some kind of return in by having the property, but as far as this redeemer is concerned, this family guardian, he's thinking, this is not a good deal for me. I mean, this could jeopardize my own inheritance, all this expense that I'm going to be having to pay, and then finally realizing I'm going to have to give up the land anyhow. I don't think so. Now, some think that that's probably wasn't really what was happening. The real facts were that Ruth was a Moabite, and he didn't really want to marry her. That could be possible too. But either way, he didn't want to follow through on this. And because of Boaz's prudence and his ability to hold back his emotions and just to present himself as a person who's interested but not that interested, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's like, I remember going to Jerusalem, and one of the things it's fun to do when you go to Jerusalem is go to the market. And they have these old parts of the town where these narrow streets, you've probably seen these kind of things, where they have different market spots where they have food, they have clothes, they have tourist knickknacks and everything. And as you're walking down the street, someone yells up, "Friend, I have a deal for you. Come in here. Because I like you, I'm going to give you the best deal in Jerusalem. Come in to my shop. I show you. You know, and they do the whole thing, you know. And you go, what, okay, yeah, I kind of, that's nice. I like that. How much do you want? $25. Okay, that sounds good. I'll buy it. Don't do that. You don't ever do that. When you go into a shop, first of all, you go, I'm not that interested. There's not much here. What's that over there? Oh, wow. It's made of wood. I don't know about wood. You have to kind of do that. And then going, oh, this is the best wood in town. I mean, this is olive wood. Jesus used this wood. You know, and they're just building this up. And you go, I don't know. I just, how much do you think? Oh, $25. Oh, golly, are you kidding me? No way would anybody pay $25 for that. That is ridiculous. I would only pay five. Oh, you ruined me. You know, and you go through this little rigmarole, you know, kind of thing. Until you get to the end and you go, okay, $10. You know, and you come to the price. And he's going, I really got him this time. And you're going, I really got him this time. And you go, you know, everybody's satisfied because you know ahead of time that's all you're going to spend, $10. You're not going to spend more, and this is how you negotiate. So this is kind of what Boaz is doing. He's negotiating the situation so that he would make sure that what he really wanted took place. And he knew this man, this Mr. So-and-so, that he's probably only in it for the money. And so once he gets himself to commit to a price, then he gives him the other part of the deal so that he'll say, not that interested because it costs more money than I can't really back down on my price. My price is set. Now, if I back down, I just can't do that in front of all these witnesses. So he negotiates this thing and finds himself with this property and with Ruth. So how does this pertain to us in dealing with prudence, thinking and acting, thinking and speaking? Well, a lot of times we find ourselves, especially in these kind of situations where there is romance involved, we let our emotions control what we do. Our emotions control our decisions. And we find ourselves making decisions based on our feelings. And when you look at how people see love, love is all about feeling for people. It's all about the emotional feeling. And so when you make your decisions, you make your decisions about this relationship based on those feelings, you can find yourself in trouble. For instance, someone decides to date, and as they're dating this person, they find out, oh, they're married. But they have such strong feelings for them. And this person says, I love you. And I am going to get divorced, but I am not divorced yet. And I want you to know that I really love you. You're going, okay, they love me. I feel for them, and so I guess I'll hang in here and see how it goes. Not. Bad decision. not prudent, not wise, it'll end up badly for you. Either way it goes, it's going to be bad. Or someone you've been dating and you have affection for them, you have, and there's just a lot of heat and sparks, if you know what I mean, and the person says, you know what, let's take it to the next level. Let's make love. I mean, that's what love is, right? We want to share ourselves with each other and love each other, and let's just do that now. And you say, no, I don't know, I don't think so. Well, don't you love me? Yes, I do. Well, then let's express our love to one another. What's wrong with that? Don't do it. It's not a prudent thing to do, not a wise thing to do. And you say no, because I'm thinking more than just feeling. You've already prepared yourself for these kind of situations. You thought them through, what this situation is. And you don't let the emotional content of these things be the final decision maker for you. Now, another thing about prudent, if you want to be a prudent person, watch what people do, not just what they say. Proverbs 27:12 says this, the prudent see danger and take refuge, but the simple keep going and pay the penalty. In this situation, Ruth sees Boaz and the promises he makes and the statements he makes, and he follows through on them. He does what he says. A lot of times we find ourselves seeing danger signs, but we ignore them. And we continue to do as though those things that seem to contradict what they say aren't as important. And I think a lot of times people get confused. Because when a person makes these statements to you about how much they love you and how they feel about you, etc., etc., they're so authentic. They feel so true. But then you get confused because what they do and how they act seems to contradict what they say. And it's confusing. And you're kind of in the middle. You don't know what to do because what they say feels true, but what they do seems to contradict what they say. So what do? Go with what they do. Forget about what they say. Go with what they do. And it's good to kind of just hold back sometimes. Somebody make a promise, somebody makes these statements of love and devotion, well, let them show it first. If they don't show it, they don't mean it. And if they don't mean it, you don't want it. And it's basically that kind of situation. And here, prudence says, I see the danger. I see what they do, and I go by what they do more than what they say. Now, I have people a lot of times come to me and say, I really feel this way, Pastor, and I want to do this, da, 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 da. And I go, okay, terrific, wonderful. And I just wait. And I watch. And I see if they do what they promised. And if they don't do what they promised, then I go, they didn't mean it. They felt it, but they didn't really mean it. And there's a big difference. You could feel it, but not mean it. Because meaning it cost. And if not willing to pay the cost, then all it is just the feelings that you whipped up at the moment. And it's worthless. Now, verse 7 says this. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption of and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the family guardian said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. And then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead and his property, so that his name will not disappear from among this family or from his hometown. Today, you are witnesses." So now Boaz is making known in front of all the elders and the family guardian and all the witnesses there that he's making this commitment. He's making this commitment to buy this property, but he's also making his commitment to marry Ruth and to pass on Elimelech's name so that the family name would continue. Now, we saw earlier the interactions that Ruth had with Boaz, and Boaz is impressed with her. He says, "Everybody's talking about your character. Everybody's talking about what a quality person you are." And he talks to her and says, "You know, you have showed this kindness to Naomi, and you have come under the wing, so to speak, under the protection of our God, and you've made him your God, and you've made these people your people. You've left your people and made these people your people." And he talks about her decisions and her actions. And then when he is informed by her that she wants him, she has chosen him, he says, "Of all the people you could have chosen a younger man, one of them, but you chose me, and this is a kindness that far outweighs the kindness you showed to Naomi." And you see the way he reacts and what he says, that he has deep feelings for Ruth. But it's not just feelings he has. He's willing to back up his feelings with actions, with commitment. And so he, in front of everyone, makes this commitment to buy the land and to make the investments that are needed, both in time and energy and love, to Naomi, to Ruth, and to their future family. And he expresses this to everyone and wants everybody to know. He doesn't want this to be a secret. He wants everybody to know that this is his intentions and this is what he's going to do. Now, a scripture strikes me that kind of summarizes this. And it's Matthew chapter 6 and verse 21. And it says, "Wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will also be." This is true here for Boaz. Where his treasure is, that's where his desire is. His desire is for Ruth. And he's willing to put all that he is, all that his treasures, in that investment. Now, what does commitment have to do with love? Because in our world today, commitment and love seem to be incompatible. People don't really like that word when it comes to love relationships. In fact, someone has said this: "If I want to be with a man and he with me, why can't we just agree to be together and that's that? Why all of the vows, rings, stigma, governmental involvement, and harsh rules? Marriage is a business. It's not about love or emotional connection. It's about feeling. This love is about feeling. It's not about feeling. That's not what marriage is. It's about owning the other person." That's their statement. Now, in other words, they're saying basically love is enough. Why do we need to get married? Why do you need commitment? Why do you have to have vows? Why do you have to get married? And have all this other baggage that'll basically ruin what we feel for one another. Now, is that true? Well, it depends on what the word love means to you. In this statement, the definition of love is all about how you feel. It's about the passion. It's about the other person and how he makes you feel, what he does for you, and how you feel about this. It's what you receive from the relationship. It's all subjective. And in modern culture, people believe that in order for you to be happy, you have to find that perfect soulmate, the one that was made for you, that when you see them, sparks fly, and you have this connection, and you have this a passion for one another. And that romance is the most important part of a successful marriage or relationship. And marriage doesn't mean until death you part. It means until the feeling's gone, until my needs are no longer met. And then the best solution is to dissolve this relationship or dissolve this marriage. Now, if that's what you believe, then commitment doesn't matter. If that's what really love means, then commitment doesn't matter. But the fact is that if that's what you believe love is all about, then you probably will never experience long-lasting love. And I think there's a lot of fear, especially when it comes to marriage for young people. They don't have a lot of faith that their marriage and their relationship can last. And so they want to kind of hedge their bets, make sure that there's a way out. They don't want to go through what their parents went through or other people that they know went through. They feel that marriage is a love killer. It destroys love, the spontaneity. It talks about duty, about responsibility, about commitment. And that just kills the spontaneity of affection and love that you have in a romantic relationship. So why not just live together and take a test drive? That's a very popular view. Check it out first. Move in together and see how it works. And if it works well, then maybe we can move on to marriage. We'll just see how it works. The fact is when you do that, you're not really test driving something. You're not really kicking the tires. You're not, because that is not what you're buying. What you see in that relationship when you move in together is not what you're really going to be buying. Why is that? Because it is a test drive. People are going to be on their best behavior. They're going to hedge their bets too. They won't show all the dirty laundry, if you know what I mean. They won't let their hair down. They're going to be guarded about who they are. And so you have two people who are guarded. They're not ready to commit. They're not ready to say, I'm all in. And so there's this reticence to open up. There's this reticence to be who they really are and to be on your best behavior. And data shows that those who move in together have a higher rate of divorce if they ever move on to marriage. Over 50% do get divorced. In fact, there was research done that found that 15 out of every 100 cohabiting couples were unmarried after a decade. Or there were only 15 left out of 100. So you have 85 out of 100 that get divorced after 10 years. So when we look at that kind of relationship, it doesn't have what it takes to last. It doesn't have the ingredients necessary to last. Because feelings, I don't know if you know this or not, they come and go. Have you ever talked to a person who's been married for less than a year? How they feel? They just have a perpetual smile on their face. They're just usually, they're just like, oh, this is fantastic. Give them a year. And the real person starts to come out. and the smile leaves. Why? Because they don't feel the same thing anymore because of how that person now is acting and reacting. It's kind of like this. These kind of relationships are more of a consumer type of relationship. And what do I mean by that? Your relationship with your grocer. You like your grocer, nice friend, nice person, but they give you a good product, give you good produce, for instance, at a good price. But let's say in time you've been with them for a year and you've been going to this place for a year and they give you good produce for a good price, and all of a sudden another grocer comes in and they give you better produce, fresher, at a lower price. Now, what are you going to do? You go with the other grocer. Well, what happened to the relationship? See, the relationship is not as important as the product I'm buying and what it does for me. The same thing is with these kind of relationships. As soon as they see something better, strain on the relationship, and the relationship can end. Why? Because it's not about the relationship. It's about how it makes you feel. And I always feel better when I get a better product for a lower price. So it's what I get out of it. So let's say they're not feeling as well about the relationship, and they run across another person, and they make them feel really good. Guess what? I'm going to a different grocer. I'm going somewhere else. This is built in to these kind of relationships because they don't have the foundation of commitment that enables them to last. So why is commitment important for long-term relationships? Well, first of all, it's because God created marriage. And he created marriage with commitment. You remember in the book of Genesis where God said it's not good for Adam to be alone, and he's going to create a helpmate for him. And then it talks about and says, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and then the two shall become one flesh. Notice the order of things. They leave and cleave. They leave their other alliances, and this becomes the primary one. They make a cleaving, a commitment to this person. Then what follows this commitment? Oneness. Commitment brings about the oneness, and the sexual activity or the sexual part of love cements that oneness. If you try to do it without commitment, the oneness that comes through physical relations, sexual relations, is not strong enough. It's not strong enough to keep the relationship lasting. And so you find that they don't last. So commitment, things that commitment does, it makes marriage more intimate. Intimacy is what we're looking for when we're talking about marriage. A way that you can use this phrase that kind of makes it, gives an insight to it. Just slow the word down a little bit and say, into me see. That's what intimacy is. It's where you're able to not only be naked, because that's what people think of when they think of intimacy. They think of a person who's naked and is making love. That's intimacy. But it's not just a physical. It's an emotional and a person where all your secrets, all who you are, is then opened up so they can see. You're vulnerable. Your weaknesses, your strengths, they're all there for them to see. And they open up to you. And then you come together because of this commitment to one another, knowing everything about each other, and this bond is deeper and stronger. So when you have commitment, it makes it so that you can continue this unveiling process longer. Because there are times when feelings aren't there, where times are tough. And having that commitment says, I'm here. And let me just back up a little bit. When we talk about commitment like this, we're making promises. You know, when you are in a church and you see a couple getting married, what do? They stand in front of the pastor and then they make these promises. They make vows. Now, think about a biblical marriage. When they make a vow, it's about the future. It's not about now. It's about the future. They don't say, you know what, I just want you to know today I feel so overwhelmed with feelings of love for you. I just want to cry. I can't believe how wonderful you are. I feel like you're the best person I've ever met. Well, that's all wonderful. But that's not what vows are about. Vows are about the future, saying, I'm going to be loving in the future. I'm going to be loving when I don't feel loving. I'm going to act loving when I don't feel loving in the future. I'm making a commitment to you that that's what I'm going to do. When you have that kind of commitment, then there's more ability to open up over time. Another thing it brings is stability. again, it's about this commitment, about this promise, and that you will love one another. There's studies been done. They have found that marriages that are in trouble, that 2/3 of them, if they will but stay in the marriage for 5 years and work on their marriage, what was so unhappy at the beginning becomes a happy marriage. They need something that commits them to stay in there and hang in there. Now, what if happens if your ultimate goal is that I need to be happy, I need to feel, and it doesn't happen after the first year? What's the alternative? Well, hang in there and stick it out, hoping that they'll change. Usually that's not the case. It's just not enough. They bail. See, the fact is that love, as far as the Bible describes love and defines love, is about action. When you look at love in the Bible, it's all about action. God so loved the world that he just felt wonderful. No. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. He acted. Action describes love. Now, obviously, when you make these kind of commitments and you do these things, there's this feeling that it's involved. It's human. It's wonderful. It's nothing that's wrong with it. It just is not enough by itself. And the fact is that having love that's an action eventually creates feeling. Tell me, if I treat you in a way that's demeaning, that's dismissive, that is rude, that is mean, and I do this over a period of time, what happens to your feelings? They diminish, they change, they become something less than what you had at the beginning. My actions affect your feelings. Now, what if I treat you with respect, with kindness, devotion, attention, appreciation, value you, and I treat you that way? what kind of feelings will you have? Well, your feelings will change. In fact, the person who acts that way, who acts loving, their feelings change. It's amazing that our actions influence our feelings. In fact, this is what the Bible talks about, is that we act our way into feelings rather than feel our way into actions. And so when we talk about this commitment, it's necessary in order to develop a deeper love. See, the fact is that being committed enables us to dive into the relationship. If you're not committed, there's always an open door. There's always a pulling back. There's always holding reserve. And you're basically always on the outskirts. You're always on the surface. You can never really go far and in deep because you won't take the risk. You won't open up. You won't go there. The fact is that having the commitment enables us to really have intimacy, to be able to beyond the surface and go deeper into the relationship. Finally, commitment enables freedom. It's freeing. Now, you would think that would be just the opposite. If you make a vow to someone, what you're doing is saying, I'm limiting my options, correct? I promise to be faithful to you and you only. I promise to love you. That limits your options. And people think that that is very limiting, and therefore it's not freedom. The fact is that when you limit those options, you're basically also making it possible for you to do the thing that makes the relationship good. In other words, let me put it this way. We have the ability to be impulsive, to have our desires control us. And many people who live by this feeling only, as far as love is concerned, they're victims to whatever they feel at the time. They're not free. They don't have freedom. They are at the beck and call of their desires. So when we make these commitments, we limit those kind of things that can ruin our relationship. Another thing, too, when it talks about it's free, it enables us to not be paralyzed. Have you ever heard of someone saying, you know, I don't want to get married right yet. She's a great girl, but I want to keep my options open. There might be somebody else along. I knew a guy, he'd date people, and he just wouldn't settle on any of them because he was always looking for the ideal, and he was always looking for the mysterious one. And so he found himself, there were so many choices out there that he was paralyzed, and he couldn't make any choices. Now tell me, is that freedom? No, it's not freedom, being paralyzed like that. To know what you want and have it and being committed to it is freedom. So, when we talk about this relationship of Ruth and Boaz, God had set this up. They were devoted to each other. And you'll see that they're in the line of King David and in the line of Jesus. It shows us some things about relationship that we need desperately in our culture today, that we put God's pattern and his blueprint for marriage, blueprint for relationships into play, and it saves us so much misery and so much heartache when we follow what God says. Now, do we do that? No. But there's always hope. God takes us wherever we are, enables us to take the next step. Doing the will of God whenever you do it is better than not doing it. The promise is always there. Wherever you are, whatever relationship you find yourself, doing the right thing, going back to what God says, makes potential for God's hand being involved in that relationship and bringing about what he wants. Because what he wants for you is good. Turn to him. Follow what he has to say. And you'll find your life a lot better. Father, we thank you again for this time that we have to study your word. We just pray, Lord, that you would just help us as we contemplate these things. May your Holy Spirit bring to remembrance those things, Lord, that we need to know and we need to see. And we find ourselves putting into practice those things, your truth, in our relationships, in our lives. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you and have a wonderful week, and we'll see you after Thanksgiving.